Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, elections highlight corporate news media's partisan prism, the insistence on reading things preeminently in terms of what they mean for the fortunes of one major party or the other, and calling a good story one that lets them trade claims. But as one of the key times in which people visibly engage with power, there's hardly a time more important than elections for media to stop splitting the difference and, frankly, describe the impact of elections, not just the outcomes, but the processes on people and their ability to have a say in their circumstances. We'll talk about what the 2018 midterms told us about voting in this country with Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones and the author, most recently, of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, out now in paperback. Also on the show, quote, in a setback for the Trump administration, a federal judge has blocked a permit for construction of the Keystone XL oil pipeline from Canada and ordered officials to conduct a new environmental review. Close quote. Well, that's the Associated Press's lead on a story about a U.S. district judge's ruling that the Trump White House was not within bounds to simply ignore years of data on the impact of the Keystone extension on the climate, indigenous communities, and endangered species in summarily scrapping Obama's veto on pipeline construction. AP's not wrong that the decision is a setback for Trump's agenda, but when life itself is a factor in a news event, you'd hope reporters would now and again make it the subject of a sentence. We'll talk about what the ruling on Keystone XL could mean, short-term and long-term, with Jackie Prang, senior attorney and managing litigator with the Natural Resources Defense Council. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. You can read analysis all day long about the effect of the 2018 midterm elections on Republicans, on Democrats, on Congress, and on Donald Trump. But in an election that saw broken voting machines, overheated machines, missing machines, confusion over absentee ballots, over provisional ballots, long lines, someone needs to be looking out for what the midterms meant and mean for people. We are joined now by Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter at Mother Jones and author of, most recently, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, out now in paperback. Ari Berman, welcome back to Counterspin.
Hey, Janine. Thanks for having me back.
So we're recording this on November 15th. Not even everything from the midterms is absolutely settled. There are lots of things we could talk about, but let's start, I guess, with Florida and Georgia, places where the races have been very, very tight and have gone to recount. From the perspective of somebody who's focused on voting and on every vote counting, are there particular lessons or questions or concerns coming out of those two states for you right now?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions and concerns about both states. And the issues are a little bit different in the two places, but there's a lot of similarity too. I mean, in Georgia, you had a Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, who was also running for governor, essentially overseeing his election, who put in place a number of restrictive policies, from aggressively purging the voter rolls to putting thousands of people on pending registration lists, to counties aggressively rejecting absentee ballots, to closing polling places, to very, very long lines, 4-hour lines. In Atlanta, all of which created a lot of confusion and a lot of people not being able to vote or counting disputed ballots. And now that's a very, very close election that may or may not go to a runoff. But you're looking at, you know, Kemp is up by 55,000 votes. He's about 17,000 votes away from going to a runoff. And you're wondering, you know, if there are thousands of people who are disenfranchised or potentially disenfranchised, that seems to have had at least some impact on the election. In Florida, what happened is basically the governor's race and the Senate race were very close, and Republicans started making totally outlandish claims about voter fraud, even though there was no evidence of fraud, because they didn't want to count every vote. And now we're learning there was a lot of problems with the election there, too. There were over 20,000 absentee ballots that were rejected. And so it looks like there, in Georgia, the kind of question is the count in the first place an accurate count because of people disenfranchised? In Florida, it's a question of, are we even going to count all the votes? Because Republicans keep trying to stop the count before we even get to a recount. And so I think in both states, there's just a lot of questions about the fairness and validity of the elections.
Well, and in terms of coverage, and I'll just stick with Florida for a second, the idea of, well, Republicans are saying there might be fraud and charges and countercharges. And then I'm reading a kind of story that basically says, well, yeah, here's why it would be the GOP strategy to do this. They basically are trying to work the recount the way they see it as another campaign. All of it seems to kind of devolve voting down to like very small p politics. And I'm just wondering, because what you might come away with is a pox on both their houses. And that's not really an appropriate takeaway, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, this has been a strategy entirely driven by Republicans. In Georgia, they drove a strategy to make it harder for people to vote, particularly for people that might have supported Stacey Abrams in her bid to become the first Black woman governor. I mean, pretty much every restrictive voting law that Brian Kemp put into place disproportionately affected African-American, Latino, Asian-American voters who were far more likely to support Stacey Abrams. And in Florida, what they've done is they've just had a strategy all along to raise doubts about the count so that there is no recount. I mean, essentially, they have said that they don't want every vote to count. And so the strategy is a little bit different in both states, because right now, Brian Kemp is kind of a little bit further removed from the process now that he has finally resigned as Secretary of State. Was Rick Scott is both governor of Florida and a Senate candidate, so he remains very enmeshed in these two things. But I think overall in both places, there's a thought that really the Republicans there just don't want all the votes to count, that Republicans in Georgia don't want disputed absentee ballots, disputed provisional ballots to count, and same thing in Florida, they don't want disputed absentee ballots to count. They don't want this to go to a recount. But you can't just view this as a technical political dispute. You have to view this in the larger context of the Republican Party has been committed to making it harder to vote, and they have put in place very restrictive policies in places like Georgia and Florida that it's made it harder to do so.
Well, I was just going to say, this isn't coming out of nowhere. We have talked in the past about suppressive measures that tend to restrict people's ability to vote, things like exact match signatures and things like that. But it's part of a history, and that history has always been lopsided in terms of who is trying to cut people out.
It is. And I mean, there's a very long history in this country. You can go back a long way and look at voter disenfranchisement. But just more recently, if you look, 24 states had new voting restrictions in effect for the 2018 election. That means nearly half the states in the country had one law or another that made it harder to vote. You also had the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act in 2013, ruling that states with a long history of discrimination no longer needed to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That allowed Georgia, for example, to put in place a lot of suppressive voting laws that would have otherwise been blocked. And so I think between the restrictions passed by Republicans and then the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act, I feel like states like Georgia felt like they had a free hand to just discriminate against people. And then you had the added dimension of candidates that had put in place suppressive voting laws overseeing their own elections, which was just a fundamental conflict of interest that certainly swayed votes towards one candidate in Georgia at the expense of another.
Well, another kind of bigger picture issue, Amendment 4 in Florida about returning the vote to those who've served time on felony convictions. Long term, that sounds like something that's significant.
Yeah, there was some good news amidst all the suppression. A half dozen states passed ballot initiatives that will make it easier to vote. Florida passed a ballot initiative that could restore voting rights to up to 1.4 million ex-felons, which is a huge number of people. Michigan and Nevada and Maryland passed reforms like automatic registration and Election Day registration that will make it easier to register to vote. Three different states, Colorado, Michigan, and Missouri, passed independent redistricting commissions. So, I mean, you had both in purple and in red states, voters coming out and supporting initiatives to make it easier to vote, which led me to believe that there's actually a lot of support in this country for making voting more convenient, for expanding voting access, and that whereas the politicians, the Brian Kemps and the Rick Scotts of the world, want to restrict voting rights, I think among the public, even among many Republicans, there is support for a broad pro-democracy agenda, that people think that if you've made a mistake, you should get a second chance to vote. They think that people should have opportunities to register to vote to make it easy and convenient. They think that you should have more time to vote in terms of early voting. They don't think that politicians should be drawing their own districts. I mean, there's a lot of support for a pro-democracy agenda, and that gets missed a lot of times in all the coverage of the suppression that Republicans are doing, because those are Republican officials, but then there's something of a disconnect between the electorate more broadly and what politicians in charge are doing.
Well, absolutely. And if we do have the GOP playing a very long game and a very multi-front game, another front of that that I know that you've talked about is the census. And I would just pick up on the fact that, as you're saying, folks are on to them. You know, there is an awareness of the coherence of these various measures that vote suppressors are taking, you know, and there's a fight back to it. But could you talk a little bit about the relationship that the census plays here, because it fits right in?
This is a really critical fight right now, because the Trump administration added a question about U.S. citizenship to the census for the first time since 1950. There's a lot of fear that that will depress response rates from immigrant communities, from non-citizens. If that happens, that means that areas with lots of immigrants, with lots of non-citizens, diverse areas like California, New York, and Texas will receive fewer resources. They'll receive less political representation. They won't potentially count for redistricting purposes after the 2020 redistricting process. And so the census has come to the GOP's long game for rigging democracy, because the census determines how $675 billion in federal funding is spent. It determines how legislative districts are drawn. It determines how many electoral votes states get. And if you start manipulating the census to try to make certain areas, certain communities have less power, then American democracy itself gets fundamentally skewed. And so this is really their strategy post-2020. And I think their strategy for trying to keep power in the face of massive demographic change, because if you just don't count people, if you just say these people don't exist even though they are here, you can deny them really significant economic and political resources. And I think that's really what they're trying to do with adding this question to the census, which is now being litigated. There was just a trial in New York, and there's going to be other trials challenging this. So it's a little under the radar at the moment, given all the other election stuff, but I think the census is a really critical long-term fight for our democracy.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I do feel that there's been a spotlight on the process of voting. You know, we at FAIR, we've seen, for example, media doing that same thing of saying long lines of people waiting to vote, but then other people saying, wait a minute, long lines actually are not a sign of, you know, a healthy democracy. That's actually a problem. You know, I do see more focus on the process itself. But what would you like to see journalists following up on? We know that they're very race-focused, they're very outcome-focused, but there's a lot left on the ground here in terms of democracy itself that they could be reporting out right now.
I do. I mean, I think the coverage in 2018 was better than 2016. I think a lot of people just got sidetracked by the Trump reality show in 2016 and didn't focus on the voter suppression we were seeing in Wisconsin and North Carolina and Texas and other states. I think when you remove Trump from the equation a little bit, then we just had such blatant suppression efforts in states like Georgia, for example, people began to cover it more closely. But I do worry about false equivalence here. I do worry about media saying, well, you know, Democrats are alleging voter suppression and Republicans are alleging voter fraud and treating this as a both sides issue, when in fact we know definitively there was voter suppression in the election and there was no voter fraud. And so I think if this is covered as a he said, she said partisan issue, that is very problematic. I think we have to be very clear here with what's happening, which is that Republicans deliberately implemented a strategy to make it harder to vote in states like Georgia, that may have allowed them to win the election. And I think it needs to be covered like that. And then I think, you know, when there's all of this crazy rhetoric about voter fraud, I think you have to clearly say this is false. There's no evidence of this. This is a political strategy. You can't just say Trump alleges mass voter fraud and put that in a tweet when people aren't going to read the fifth paragraph saying this isn't true. And so I think the narrative has to be very clearly that this isn't true, this is a lie, and that Republicans are manufacturing this lie to try to build support for even more restrictive voting efforts to help them win in future elections. So I think the media is getting better at covering this, but I don't think they're there yet.
We've been speaking with Ari Berman. He's a senior reporter at Mother Jones, and he's author of, most recently, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, which is out now in paperback. Ari Berman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine. I appreciate it.
One of the first things Donald Trump did upon taking office was to reverse the Obama administration's permit rejection for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would move crude from oil sands in Canada to Oklahoma and the Gulf Coast. Restarting work on this extension of the existing Keystone pipeline, along with greenlighting the likewise hotly contested Dakota Access pipeline, was part of what one newspaper called Trump's ambitious plans for a U.S. makeover. A federal judge has just blocked construction on Keystone XL again, however, seeming to suggest essentially that Trump's because I want to reasoning was insufficiently persuasive. Here to help us understand this ruling and where it leaves us is Jackie Prang, senior attorney and managing litigator with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome to Counterspin, Jackie Prang.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's look into this ruling from Brian Morris of the U.S. District Court in Montana. What does it say that's significant?
Well, there are a couple things in the ruling that are significant. And first off, what you mentioned earlier, I think, is the main point, which is that construction on the pipeline is blocked by this order. And the reason the court felt that there shouldn't be any construction is because the environmental review documents underlying the approval of the pipeline were flawed and need to be revisited by the administration.
Well, the judge lists a few things, essentially, that the Trump administration did wrong in their abrupt reversal of the Obama administration's ruling. What were some of the things that he suggested had been done inappropriately or ignored?
Part of this goes back to some of the history here, and it's important to remember that in 2015, the Obama administration denied the pipeline, rejected it because of its climate and other impacts. And when the Trump administration tried to reverse that decision and fast-track it, it didn't do what it was supposed to under the law. It relied on very old environmental review documents that were there since the Obama administration. These documents were prepared in 2014. And so it was using those documents many years later to support an approval of the pipeline when they had previously supported a denial of the pipeline. And so the judge ordered the government to go back and review changes that had happened since 2014 that are really critical. For example, changes in the oil market. Since 2014, there's been a huge drop in oil prices, and that could affect whether this pipeline is viable and whether it will increase the rate of tar sands production in Canada. This pipeline is designed to bring dirty tar sands fuel to the United States from Canada. And one of the big areas of dispute is whether that would happen anyways and without the pipeline. And so oil prices are really critical to that decision. Some other things that the government needs to address is whether there will be cumulative effects with approvals of other pipelines on greenhouse gases. And the administration also ignored important information, new information about oil spills, including a big oil spill on another pipeline, the Keystone 1 pipeline, we call it, that TransCanada is currently operated. There was a large spill just last year that was not covered in the environmental review documents. And there's also one other different sort of claim that I think is really important and telling about how the Trump administration dealt with this approval. What the court said was, in deciding that this pipeline was in the national interest, the Trump administration had simply disregarded prior factual findings regarding climate change. So in 2015, the Obama administration said this pipeline is not in our national interest because of its effects on climate change and because it harms the U.S.'s leadership role on the issue. And then in 2017, the Trump administration reversed that finding without any sort of reasoned explanation. The court said that can't happen and sent it back on those grounds.
Well, the ruling is being framed everywhere as a setback for Trump. And it is, certainly on some level. But that seems to me to be helping him to dismiss the ruling as merely political. And it seems more important to talk about what the ruling means for the planet, for the environment, for the indigenous communities that that pipeline would go through, for the air and the water. I mean, this framing of it as a kind of Obama did it, Trump took it back, seems to be me to be missing the real core here.
Yes, that's right. And this is really an extremely large pipeline for a very dirty oil source. And I think that's important for people to understand. We're not just talking about any oil. We're talking about tar sands oil that is, in many cases, strip mined from the earth and one of the most carbon intensive fuels on the planet. Yes, it could have extremely detrimental impacts on local communities, including indigenous communities, and especially on water. This pipeline is going to cross many water bodies. So that's absolutely true. And I think it also speaks to a larger importance about how this administration deals with facts and deals with the fact of climate change. Here, the Trump administration wanted to just ignore that or sweep that under the rug. And the court is saying, no, that can't happen.
Well, I'm a little concerned about this idea that I'm seeing in some stories that, well, they need to go back and make a better case, or as I've seen it put in some places, they need to show their work. You know, they need to explain why they reversed this Obama rejection. But I mean, is there really a schema in which a tar sands pipeline can be shown to not contribute to greenhouse gases and endanger land and water? It almost sounds like if they could just hit on the right formula for selling it, that it would somehow make sense. I'm not sure I understand that.
I mean, no, these pipelines are, especially, and tar sands in particular, do have extremely important impacts on our climate. And so that is true that, you know, the ruling, I think it's important for people to understand that this was a huge win, and it's very important for the rule of law and for the importance of facts and truth. But at the same time, this is just one battle. This war is not over yet. And what's going to happen is there's another opportunity for the administration to consider this decision and consider the facts. What the ultimate outcome of that will be, I can't say yet. Maybe we have a clue based on past behavior. But the win is significant in that it does require adherence to the rule of law. But this project is not dead yet by any means. And I do think it's important for people to understand that and to understand that the fight's going to continue.
Well, absolutely. Of course, being that it is a business, slowing it down can also have its own impact. But I guess I'm struck by news reports that are emphasizing construction's temporarily halted or delayed. And I know that that's literally true, but I'm concerned by this undertone of kind of inevitability, you know, not just of this pipeline, but basically of the U.S. just extracting every last bit of fossil fuel that's there, despite what we know about the impact on the climate. But then, you know, you turn to another page in the paper and you read about Wales, you know, or you read about Spain. It seems like other countries are showing us models to make keep it in the ground be what we're really doing to make it more than a slogan. It's not that it's impossible.
And I know it's hard in these times to be optimistic. You know, the most recent IPCC report was really hard to take. And obviously the administration's utter refusal to consider the reality of climate change is very difficult. But I think this is a glimmer of hope in that broader picture, in that at least parts of our government, including the judicial branch, are taking climate change seriously, and that there is some hope, and that it matters whether the government can just say, we totally are going to ignore all the facts, and that can't hold up in court. So I try to remain optimistic. I do know it's hard in these times, but I do think there is still hope.
Absolutely. And well, what else can you do? Well, let me just ask you finally, I know that the NRDC has been involved in this case along with Indigenous Environmental Network and the Center for Biological Diversity. There's a lot of work that goes into a case like this, and it isn't just lawyers. There's a whole lot of folks who are working on the Keystone case, just as on Dakota Access, and it's not just about defeating a particular pipeline, but groups are being formed and communities are being formed and folks are kind of finding their strength in a new way. I mean, even outside the law, there's a lot that's positive that's going on.
That's absolutely true. And this case and my participation in this case is just one small part. It's really the advocacy of so many people and groups over the years that have even gotten us to this point where if they hadn't been involved, this pipeline would have been built years ago. And so certainly, and there are many tools left in the tool basket. There's the Nebraska Supreme Court is currently considering the route through Nebraska. And so there are many different fronts on which the fight continues. This is just one of them. And I think that's absolutely true, that everyone has a different part to play.
We've been speaking with Jackie Prang, senior attorney and managing litigator with the Natural Resources Defense Council. You can find their work online at nrdc.org. Jackie Prang, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website. That's FAIR.org. The website is also the place to look into subscriptions to FAIR's newsletter Extra or to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.